Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Hi, everyone. Today, the Wall Street Journal published an article that some of you read called The Rockstar Librarians Who Choose What Your Kids Read. The fallout from this article occurred mostly over social media, over a great deal of misfortunes around the content that the article focused on, namely that it chose to focus on three individuals, myself included, that all were white males in their mid-30s. The abhorrent lack of diversity is embarrassing and quite unfortunate that we have the opportunity to lift up school librarians, and the Wall Street Journal does it in this nature. The author, Ellen Gamerman, I'm sure received many emails already so far, and if you want to read the article and reply to her, her email address is included at the end of the article. The problem facing children's publishing right now, and those of us that work on the side that I do in promotion and connecting with children, is that we seem to think that there are these gatekeepers, these magical individuals that if we put so much emphasis on their taste mattering, they are the ones that will decide what books get selected, what books get celebrated, what books get into the hands of kids. And it's just not that way. There is some truth to it, but the real truth is that we all of us, are charged with being champions of children's books, of lifting them up, of sharing them to others. Some of us have accrued a larger following online, mostly because we talk so much about those books, and because of the way that we're leading others in our opinions, others choose to follow those opinions. Now, I follow a good number of people as well for the way they lead me in book recommendations, in reading incentives, in different teaching approaches. I love being able to learn from the hive, being able to be part of a community. But the community suffers when things like this happen, when we are spotlighting a select few, a chosen few, and especially when we are lacking in diversity in who we represent. So I charge all of us to do better, to read this article, to write to Ellen Gamerman and the Wall Street Journal, and to challenge ourselves to make change in the world. Another thing I took offense with in the article is the way they misquoted me for what I said at the SCBWI conference, in which I spoke to a group of people at a pre-conference session about grassroots marketing, saying that the best way to engage me and others like me and to engage us to talk about your book is by being part of the community, by engaging us that way, by sending books to us, but knowing that we might not connect with your books, or we might not get to them right away, and that's okay. Where I was misquoted was that they said that I then went on to say that if you're rude to me online, that I don't need to worry about you. I don't have time for you. I'll go on to somebody else who I'm, you know, willing to have be kind to me. This just isn't the case. I am fully willing for you to agree or disagree with my opinions. I do look for people that I personally connect with to be on this show in particular, but that is fully my choice because I am the host of the podcast and I want to be able to bring you the best conversations that I can. And to do so, I need to love the books and the people behind them. So this is all just to say that what happened with the Wall Street Journal today, I think, is something that we all should be concerned with and we all should pay attention to and make change from. So I challenge you all to do that. Thank you for listening. And now, on to the show. Meet Alessandra Balzer, co-publisher of Balzer and Bray. Welcome to All the Wonders, the children's book podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 334 of the podcast with Alessandra Balzer. With Donna Bray, Alessandra has been publishing some of my absolute favorite picture books and novels from the past few years, including Worm Loves Worm, Swatch, and Pax. We've also interacted a bunch over email and Twitter when coordinating podcast guests and features for All the Wonders. Having the chance to learn firsthand what it means to run an imprint and be an editor was a particularly special opportunity for me, and I'm glad I made the connection with Alessandra. Here's episode number 334 of the podcast with Alessandra Balzer. Welcome to the podcast, Alessandra Balzer. I have longed to talk to you.
I'm so excited to be on here. I love your interviews. I feel like they're always so thoughtful.
Oh, thank you.
And you always often ask questions that other people don't. I love your podcast. I think it's such a great, you know, I could just spend hours listening to people talk about their work.
You're very kind. Sure. And I'm glad that the format is one that connects with you and with others, because I like this. I like just being able to sit down and have sort of that personal conversation that we end up sharing later. And I have to say, I didn't want to say this to you before we started recording, but I maybe have never been more nervous to talk to someone than you.
Why?
Because you're like in my category with like talking to Ed Young and other people like that, Katie Camillo and people like that, because So if I talk about that, it's easier for me to talk about them because I'm going to get really nervous if I really talk directly about you. But I know their work and I love their work. And then right before recording, I get swept with that wave of, oh, they're doing things that are so much bigger than I can even wrap my brain around. And for you, my friend, that came in the form of, on the yarn the other week, Mo Willems was interviewed and he name dropped you, and I was like, oh my God, Alessandra's connected to everybody.
So are you.
Well, I have so much love for your imprint because I don't tend to know, maybe I'm coming into a place where I'm knowing imprints because I'm reviewing as much as I am, but you and Donna, you, Balzer and Bray, keep publishing stuff that I'm like, oh, we share a taste. So it's neat that we share a taste. It's neat to see that, to
That's
see
so
in
nice
that way.
Of you.
I feel like I can see your editor's hand and Donna's editor's hand because of now knowing that, like, oh, so when people submit manuscripts to different editors and different things like that, you can see that there's sort of a feel to what you publish. So I say that as a compliment. I think what you do really well. We have loved celebrating your books at All the Wonders in a myriad capacities. And just thanks.
That is so kind of you. And I so appreciate the support that you give authors and illustrators. It's not always easy to find ways to talk about picture books. You know, there's a lot of books out there. There's a lot of noise. And you give such a nice, thoughtful space to them, and you appreciate their craft in a way that means so much to them. So thank you.
You're putting it so nicely.
We're grateful.
I feel like I fanboy out and get ridiculous. So thank you for calming it down and saying it in such a nice way.
You're making my night here.
I just know that At least when my students listen, they know that, like, oh yeah, this is the guy we see every day. This is totally normal. The rest of the world, who knows? But I'm glad that, that they know.
We're like, here's the famous guy on All the Wonders.
Ay, ay, ay. So, yeah, that famous guy, and I always get to say, like, when I interview people, yeah, and I get to go back to my library tomorrow and put all of your books on hold, or they have the fighting for whatever copies, and it's just cool to be like, let me tell you how this story came to be, or how whatever came to be. And that's what I'm excited to get to know about you, because starting an imprint, after I know you've been in publishing, I know you and Donna have known each other, but the opportunity to start an imprint and to have, really to have directly your voice have such a strong influence on publishing is not something that everyone gets to do. And it I have to assume it comes from having worked hard and built a reputation that people can stand behind. So I'd love to hear, if you don't mind, a little bit about even just how you got this offer to start Balzer and Bray, or were you just like, listen, HarperCollins, you know I'm awesome. Let me publish my books.
Well, there's some funny sort of, just to take you back a little bit, with how Donna and I sort of intersected, sort of the funny story about me is that one of the things I love about publishing is that it's a mentorship, particularly in editorial, where you're working for other editors who are, you're reading their letters, you're seeing how they edit, and you learn so much from that. And it is also a very supportive environment. So I started my career at HarperCollins. I was an editorial assistant, actually working for Catherine Teagan, who's back at HarperCollins now, and also Nancy Sisco, who's at Knopf.
I know those names.
These are relationships that often continue, and people, you know, it's a small industry. So many people know each other. So I started off at HarperCollins, and Donna came to HarperCollins. She was more experienced than I was a little bit later to work for Lisa Holton, who was at the time was the head of the editorial group. She was the editor-in-chief, I believe her title was. She was such an inspiring leader. She was incredible. And so when Lisa Holton left to go to Hyperion Books for Children, part of Disney Publishing, although it was, I don't believe it was called Disney Publishing at the time.
Not yet. Yeah.
She hired some people from Hyperion. One of them was Donna, and one of them was Catherine Teagan. And then eventually I got hired over there as well to work for Howard Reeves, who's now at Abrams. So you can see how all of these people.
This is all like very normal, right? To go around the different houses?
Well, I mean, some people.
I was just going to say, I think that speaks to the kindness in children's publishing, because I feel like to be able to go to like a competing house and just be cool with that, hey, we all just sort of go around to different places, just feels nice. It feels like everyone sort of is in the same pool just trying to get books out for kids.
It is. I mean, it's not always nice for the people leaving and the, you know, sometimes you want to take authors with you and that can be complicated. But at the time I was a very junior editor. I certainly wasn't bringing any authors with me and I got to learn a whole new different. So I started off at HarperCollins. I went over to Hyperion and I got to experience a completely different culture and completely a smaller list and a newer list. And that's really exciting because Harper was an amazing place to be at in itself because it was had a backlist that just amazed me. Like Charlotte's Web and Maurice Sendak and even Frog and Toad. I mean, that was incredible to sort of start and learn there. And then to go over to Hyperion and really be able to, because it was a small list, get my hands in really as a really junior editor and create my own style and my own sensibility. And that's how I first published Mo Willems, for example.
Yeah.
But I'm jumping around a bit. So
no,
Donna and I
right.
at Hyperion together for, I think it was 12 years. And at that time, we were colleagues. Toward the end, Donna was actually my boss. She was the editorial director and I was an executive editor. So we really got to, you know, form a real bond and a real trust with each other. And the editorial relationship, it's all so subjective. It's so much about your sensibility, the way you see books and the way you see art. And Donna and I were always those people who would go to each other for an honest opinion. Like, what do you think of this design? What do you think of this text? What do you think of this marketing copy? And we always had a great time bouncing ideas off each other and getting each other's very unvarnished opinions. So we really enjoyed collaborating together that way. And eventually we decided that, Donna wanted to do something smaller rather than run a group. And I was interested in doing something different and going to the next level. And so we thought, this is interesting for us. Let's see if this is, if we could make this work at a different house. And so we talked to different places, and Harper really was enthusiastic and got it. And they were very quick to make us an offer. So it all worked out really well. And then we went over there in 2008, which of course was a terrible year for the economy. I mean, I laugh sadly because it was a bad time to be starting out. It all worked out really well, thank goodness, but it definitely was a bad turn for the economy and for publishing in general. So things really shifted.
In 2008, did you publish your first books in 2008, or was that like when you started and they came out, I assume like 2 years later or something?
2008 was when the imprint started, and I believe our first list was 2009, probably
Okay, and that's not
fall.
far.
Yeah, and the funny thing was when I was a baby editor at HarperCollins, I remember looking at Laura Gehringer, who had an imprint, and thinking like, "Wow, what an amazing thing to have an imprint! I can't even imagine what that would be like." And I remember she worked on the series "If You Give a Mouse a Cookie" for so long, and I loved those books. And I thought, "Wow, I wish I could do something like that." And then it was sort of funny because when we went back to HarperCollins, Laura Gehringer ended up eventually leaving, and Don and I took over the If You Give series. So it all sort of came back around. It's really interesting how that happens, how you can be at a certain level in your career and just think, wow, I can't even imagine something like that. And so it's very exciting that
When
that dream could actually happen.
Yeah, that it sometimes just takes time. It's not time yet, and then it is. Do you how many books do you currently publish a season at Balzer and Bray?
So at Balzer & Bray, we have six people. I'm setting this up so when I explain the number, it'll make sense.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to break down. Like, I was gonna say, like, what does your office look like? And then I realized that means nothing at all to me, but I can handle books.
So there's four senior acquiring editors.
Okay.
So it's Donna, me, Kristen Renz, and Jordan Brown. And then we have two junior editors, Vianna Siniscalchi and Kelsey Murphy. And they both also acquire, but they are also support staff. So there's four senior editors that are really acquiring and editing. And so we publish 60 books a year, which sounds like a lot, but actually between all of us, it's not so many.
And are you doing like two seasons, two, I don't know what they call it in publishing, but
We do three seasons.
3 seasons, 60, so you're doing 20 ish a season, and that's going picture books through YA. That's not a lot. You're right.
Yeah, it's really not. I mean,
Cool.
it's still a big number, but we still get to be very selective about what we're publishing.
Yeah, I think about Again, I think about your track record. I think about like this year alone, we got, oh no, it's so hard to go back all the way to the beginning of 2016. But this year we had like Worm Loves Worm was this year, right? And wasn't
Yes.
also was PAX this year? That was this year.
PAX was this year. Yeah.
And then
Wow.
Miss Bixby was this year.
Oh, that's a great one. Yeah,
No,
that's see, that's Donna worked on PAX. Jordan worked on Miss Bixby. So it's yeah, it was such a great list. It really
That's
was.
cool. I mean, it's, yeah, 60 books goes fast, but it's cool that you get to have the people that you do and the representation that you do across the board. I assume you're sort of trying to balance as you go. Do we have enough picture books? Do we have enough representation of whatever sort of age level, right?
We do. I mean, some of that we can't help because it will depend on the, submissions that we get, because obviously, we only want to buy books that we fall in love with. And But we do try to, you know, I think middle grade can be sometimes the hardest category because that middle grade voice is so tough to find, like an authentic, moving middle grade voice. So we've been publishing a lot of picture books lately, which has been super exciting.
I like that.
We do. Yeah, me too. I mean, we do try to balance. It is pretty balanced across the board, but we've been a little bit heavier in picture books recently and in teen.
Nice. Well, to know that you're leading from what do we love is a good place. Can you explain to me when you have these manuscripts coming in through different agents or slush pile or what have you, are you still, you will find a book, Alessandra, and say, this is a book that I want to publish, but do you then still bring it to a meeting and have all of you sort of agree on it? Or do you have, because your name is on the imprint, do you have sort of like, no, I have veto power and this is what we will publish this one?
It depends on the timing sometimes. If I get a book that I love, that's the most exciting feeling. Let's say it's a picture book because that's your primary interest.
By the way, I'm picturing you running around going like, Donna, read this. Because I sort of have that in the library too, like shoving the book in front of people's faces, only you have stuff that isn't a book yet.
I do. It's usually by email, even though she's like right near me in the office because we're so lazy. I just like immediately send something to her. And then I'm like, what do you think? I love this. Am I crazy? And then she'll be like, no, I love it. And, you know, we're almost always on the same page. But sometimes she'll be like, well, I like this, but, you know, this needs more arc. It needs more ending or something. But let's go back to your process question, which is what happens. So, yeah, when I get a picture book that I love, I will often shoot it right off to Donna because it's a quick read and she can sort of give me another thought right away. And then I will share it with our editorial team because I really value their judgments. And they often just have really great ideas, too. They might have good ideas for an editorial change that needs to be made, or they will sometimes just be like, look, I didn't find this funny. Not in a mean way, but like a really thoughtful discussion. I can't tell you how many times I'll come out of that meeting with really good ideas that I can later use in the story or that have maybe changed my mind. But usually when you really love something, other people will too. I mean, it just, you know, people do are pretty like-minded.
Well, and especially because when you love it, you're able to articulate it in such a way that other people can see what you see and agree and have it resonate with them or ask the right questions to have you sort of see it in a different light.
Yeah. Yeah. And so after that, I will, unless it's a rush, you know, unless every publisher is trying to jump on it and I have to move more quickly, then we'll bring it to our acquisitions meeting where sales weighs in and, you know, all our publisher weighs in, marketing folks. And, you know, in that case, I think every publisher, or I know that every publisher's process can be different. Some people don't have acquisitions meetings. I personally, you know, you wish you didn't have that extra step, but it is good to know if your salespeople think that they can sell this book. I don't want to let the author down. I want to sell the book for them. I want it to be a success. And we do also have to make money. And not every book will do that. But if the sales team is later going to come back to you and say, this book, God forbid, I found it offensive, or I find it really an original. I mean, hopefully none of those things would happen. But you want to know that going into it, and you want to know that, you know, you're making a promise to someone that you're going to sell it to sell it to the best of your ability and hopefully do a beautiful job. And it's good to know these things going in. You still sometimes can fight for what you love or change people's minds, but it's good to have the conversation for sure.
Those meetings, when you have those meetings, see, I'm sort of, I'm mesmerized at the idea of like front list titles and what books get different promotion. And especially I'm fascinated by when publicists select certain books to send to certain reviewers. That to me, I've never felt more significant than the feeling of, I think a publisher sending me a book going, I think this might be a right book for you to read. That to me speaks so much to the right book for the right child and how not every book is for every kid.
That's so true.
So when you're having those meetings, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about what that's like for the marketing team. Is that what you said? The marketing team to the publicity team, whatever the team is called, to be able to go like, oh yeah, this is awesome. We'll be able to promote this a whole lot. I picture like Swatch. Yes, we can have everyone paint their faces. It'll be the coolest thing ever.
Swatch is such a beautiful
book. God, I love that book.
Well, what we do is, so it's sales, marketing, it's the publisher. It's also finance, because that's the, you know, we're bringing in our, you know, we're saying how much we want to pay for it. And then you sort of have to back it up with a P&L statement saying how much you think it's going to sell. A P&L is a profit and loss statement.
Okay.
You project based on comparison titles in the market how much you think a book is going to sell. You can only guess, of course, but with something like the Brendan Wenzel, you know, they knew that it was going to be a huge success and that it would be, you know, there's certain books.
They all saw a cat. Yeah, it was a good, a good bet. Yeah.
Right. That was a really good bet. There's certain books that you can be like, ah, oh, why has no one ever thought of this before? So you do, you prepare your paperwork, you have your comparison titles and sales of comparison titles. We do add that in the paperwork. And then the editor goes in and gives their pitch, and they, you know, passion really moves people. And what we're doing for them is we're positioning it. Yeah. We're saying this book will really work for libraries because it talks about a subject that every kid needs to know or is in the curriculum. Or this, like in the case of Swatch, this is a gorgeous book that is about color, and it approaches it from this completely fresh way of a character who tames colors. So you definitely want to tell them, you know, you want to show them that other layer, why this book is important, why this book is going to sell, why this book is going to work in this market. And sometimes it's just a leap of faith of this book is passion, you know, this book is original and incredible and you just can't put it down. And, you know, but you sort of lay out your reasoning for why you're spending money on this, why you're taking a bet on this project. And that part of it is important, obviously.
How about for, I'm thinking of the same thing, I immediately, Louise Loves Art comes to mind, right? And I love Kelly, and I love her books, and she's very aware of that. But what really drove the whole thing home for me is when Kelly came by my school and did a school visit, and we talked, and she was saying that she's on this mission for arts education and showing kids through these Louise books different artists and different styles of art, like, you know, like minimalist and impressionist and abstractism, and that she wants to show through that. And I, first off, like my brain exploded thinking to come in, it's amazing to have that passion to come in and say, not only do I want to write a book, but I could see her passion behind it. There was such, the story was so much larger than just what was on the page. But where I'm coming to with you then, because I know you saw the same thing, because I,
talented. Yeah, I love Louise Loves Art, and Kelly's so talented.
Yeah, so where then do you, I assume that it might have to be after like the first, the success of the first book, but where do you then decide this did well for us? Why don't we look at exploring other venues? Because I know, for example, with Louise that there'll be an easy reader series as well as the picture books continuing. So you're sort of expanding the universe there for her. Where does that come in the process for you, or are you, is it something you're already thinking of when you're at this beginning meeting?
So Kelly, we were so excited about Kelly when we first had her working on a novel called Elvis and the Underdogs. And she was clearly just so special. Our art director, Allison Donnelly, had a postcard from her. She had been in the SCBWI and was clearly ready to just break out. So we hired her to do a picture book basically on this character of Louise. The postcard had, you might have seen this, Matthew, it was a little girl who was Louise drawing, and it said, "Art, it's my imagination on the outside."
Yes.
And that just told such a story already. I mean, it's rare that you see a character that has a story, but it was such a fresh way of looking at it. It was, you know, arts education is something that we all know is underfunded in schools. And, you know, it's hard to find a way to talk about art and education in a way that's not didactic. And that book was such a beautiful way of doing it. Like, she was such an irresistible character. And besides the love of art, there's also this great layer, which we're always looking for, like another layer in picture books. What's going to give it that substance, make it that book you want to read again and again? And in that case, it was the little brother and that relationship with them and learning how to be a good big sister and his course, his name is Art. So, you know, between her gorgeous artwork and this story just has so much heart to it. So yeah. We ended up signing more books before Louise even came out.
Oh, we were cool. Really excited about just it. So in the process of it.
Yep.
Oh, neat. Cool.
Yeah. So it can definitely happen when a book's already a success or when you're just so amped up for something that you're just all in. So that definitely happens too.
That's cool. Yeah, I can understand obviously that each book and each process is different, and however you anticipate how many books, you know, what's our print run going to look like and what is the marketing going to look like and what's the whatever is sort of beyond me. But being able to see before even the book comes out, oh, this is going to have some legs. We should line up some more. That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. It was very cool.
Ah, so you fall in love with every book you publish. This sounds like a dream job. I love it. How many submissions are you going through? Maybe that's typical to whatever publishers go through, but if you're publishing 60 a year, do you have like ballpark? How many do you think you look at?
Ugh. That's a really hard question. We don't take unsolicited submissions, unfortunately, because we just couldn't keep up with those. So we do only consider submissions that come from agents. Sometimes if I do a conference, like an SCBWI conference, I will, for a limited amount of time, open myself up to unsolicited submissions, but normally it's just agents. So gosh, out of those 60, I mean, hundreds and hundreds. I mean, every week we get, you know, a multitude of submissions. And it's, you know, many books are perfectly good, but they have to be, you know, great and they have to be special.
Well, even if each of you were getting one submission a day, the four of you senior editors, you're still looking at over 1,000 submissions.
Yeah, it's so many. And some of them are ridiculous, but many are just perfectly good, or they just either don't appeal to us, or they just, you know, John Cusick, who's an agent, wrote a good blog post about this. It's like he titled it "Publishers Don't Want Good Books," which was, as he admitted, really good clickbait, because of course we all want good books, but it's got to be more than that. There's so many books being published every year, and that's not to say, that's not to depress people, but it's really like you've got to really bring it. You have to have something fresh. You have to have something that people can't walk away from. You have to have a book that people will spend $17.99 to buy, and it's going to stand out in the bookstore. So that's why, you know, we turn down a lot of these. And also they have to fit our sensibility. So those are a lot of reasons, but there's a lot of publishers. So certainly there's so many different tastes out there for sure.
All of your talk really sounds like it's focusing on the story. We were sharing some questions on Facebook prior to this interview, and one is now in my mind. I wonder how much does the author's the question, I think, said something along the lines of like willingness to market, but how much does the author's presence online, or if you can see something like that, a willingness to go out there and really talk and be part of the community, does that influence a decision on a book at all? I can't imagine it would, but who knows?
I think it can influence it in a positive way. I mean, I would never buy a book just because the author was really well connected. I have to love the book too. But if the book is really good and the author is great at talking to kids, really creative, really funny, that helps a lot. So you might be a little bit more bullish, but I wouldn't not buy a book if an author wasn't connected, and I would not buy a book if I'm making sense here. I might sound confusing. Well,
I was almost starting to smile thinking like, oh, this almost gets at the celebrity author thing a little bit. But then I was like, oh yeah, but if you're BJ Novak and you can write that good of a picture book, then of course it'll sell.
Yeah. And I don't know what he was paid, but I'm sure it was a lot.
$5.
No. Yeah. Because celebrities are paid more. You know, not, it's interesting how the picture book world or the children's world levels that out. I mean, in comparison to what celebrities are paid for other things, you know, their books don't always work, because I think children's books, they have to be solid. They have to really work. And so they tend to be books that go out there, not in the case of BJ Novak, which is a really good book that has stuck around. Many of them don't stick around. So, yeah, it depends, though. I mean, I definitely would buy and have bought a celebrity books if I've loved the book.
Yeah.
So it just depends.
So to hear you articulate it, for you, when you're looking at a manuscript, what are the things that you see that tell you this is really working? You've said an original voice.
Definitely an original voice. One of the things that I love is to be surprised. And that's not to say like some crazy plot twist, but something that you don't see coming in the page turn or a turn of phrase that is really original or that you hadn't thought of that way. Like how Mo Willems in Knuffle Bunny uses like going boneless, something like that. You're like, oh my gosh, immediately what it means, but you've never said it about a child before, or something that really makes you laugh. I mean, good picture books. I'm a big fan of humor in picture books, not always the obvious kind. So I definitely, anything that can really surprise me and make me laugh, I like things that make you feel something.
That's
Just.
me. I think that's why I love your books, the feel that I just feel like I want to hold the book close after I read it.
Yes.
Yeah, I can't not talk about Swatch in that way. That book,
Oh, I love
I
Swatch. It's
just it
so
made me, I
gorgeous.
mean, it made me love Julia Dinos because of reading it. I was just like, this woman, whoever this person is behind this book, I just immediately adore her because her book just is that way. So yeah, I get that feeling, and I don't know how someone writes something and is able to step away and see themselves that they are causing that feeling, but boy, when you read a book, you just know it.
You do. I have this book called Adrift by Jessica Olean that's coming out. Actually, it's out. It's out. It just came out recently. And it has these two polar bears, and it's a friendship story. And there's this one scene where the two of them, they're on an ice floe that's melting, which is kind of a funny setup for a picture book. And these two polar bears that have nothing in common sort of have to become friends because their space is physically becoming smaller and smaller. And there's a scene where you're seeing them from an aerial view, and she's also an artist, so she does the art. And one of them is just awake, worrying about the other one. And that is so tender, and you don't expect that. It really sort of makes you choke up a little bit. And that's become a real favorite in house because it just has so much emotion to it. And that's why picture books are so amazing, is because they have so little text to work with. It's like poetry. I mean, some of them are genuinely poetry, but what they do with the spareness is just incredible.
I love in a good picture book whenever, for me, what stops me is when I get a picture book that has a spread that makes me stop. I
Yeah.
love that. And so, yeah, I know that spread that you're talking about, and that it's powerful when that happens. And Jessica's the one that did the Blobfish book, and
I love
she had
the
so many good beats in that book.
And that's so funny that someone like, I think Jess is so talented that she can go from something so funny to something so tender. But there's actually the reason why I love the Blobfish book so much. I mean, it's the humor. And for those who don't know what the Blobfish book is, it's basically a nonfiction book about the creatures who live in the deepest layer of the sea. And then there's this blobfish. So there's photographs in the background, and then there's this blobfish that's illustrated over it, kind of narrating the story. And he's waiting for you to get to him. And he's so funny because he's so deluded and confident. And so he's like, when are you going to get to me? And he's wearing a boa and he's doing all these funny things. And then when you finally get to him, he finds out that he was actually voted the ugliest animal. And that's a true story. And that's where that was like the seed of the story. And so you sort of feel for this poor guy. And at the end, all the other fish come together and like try to make him feel better. So it's got so much genuine heart, even though it's funny and ridiculous, but it has this great like sweetness, because you really feel for this poor creature who thought he was so attractive and then found out the sad truth.
Oh man, Blobfish had their moment when that came out as the world's ugliest animal. Do you remember seeing that skit on SNL? Oh my gosh, it was like my favorite.
Yes, everybody was sending that to me. It really felt like Blobfish was in the ether that time. And then there was another book about Blobfish. It was very funny. I'd never seen a book, but I'd hardly heard of Blobfish before this.
It's funny
It
that
was
it just hit it. I mean, now it's
that
narwhals.
happening.
I was telling
Yeah,
you, I don't know
now
who I was talking to.
it's narwhals.
It's
I
so
know, but
funny. Like, narwhals have existed forever and they're having a moment. It's just that to me, whenever the few times that I've had publishers and editors on, I get people asking, like when when Neil Porter was on, they were asking, like, so what trends are you seeing? And I remember him saying, like, you just don't know. You don't know what the trends are. Like, let me, oh, Blobfish are going to be huge this year. Let me acquire as many writers. Send me your Blobfish manuscripts. It's just funny that all of you end up, I mean, all of you, there's a lot of books being published, but that you end up seeing these themes or these things that are just, it's neat when that happens, that, like you're saying, there was something in the ether. There was a larger hand at work that just was like, you guys, narwhals. Am I right?
I have a book called Hello, My Name is Octocorn.
I was saying Octocorn, yes.
So funny. And it's kind of like, I saw that narwhal book at the time and I thought it was so cute, but I'm like, it's too similar to my Octocorn book. And it's not a narwhal, but it's definitely a creature, that it's a magical creature that you wouldn't necessarily expect.
That
so
book is insane.
It is.
To go, what is the, it's been too long since I've read it. There's a moment in Hello, My Name is Octocorn, I know you'll know it, when Octocorn is talking about his mom and his dad. It's like, that's the greatest. The question that we have to ask, the question that every reader is like, how did this happen? That maybe for me, that's maybe where I'm seeing your perspective of the show me something different or surprise me. The moment of like, I want this to happen. And when you deliver on it that well, it just works. It sings.
That book totally cracks me up, and it still does. One of the things that surprised me in that book was, like, all Octocorns, you know, he wants a friend, which is like that tender vulnerability. And then he says, I mean, all Octocorns, I want what anybody wants, just like cupcakes and a jet ski. It's like, what? A jet ski? Like, what the hell is that? But it's like the funniest visual.
That's so good.
And it completely takes you by surprise. But it just, it has such a tenderness and a vulnerability that that book, which was originally self-published in a slightly different format, but totally recognizable, really appeals to kids of, you know, kids who feel different, kids who feel alienated. The authors have heard from a lot of parents of kids on the autism spectrum. I mean, it's just so interesting. It really, because he's an animal that is so unusual and just really is so vulnerable and so different, that his uniqueness is really what's great about him. And that's such a great message for kids.
Yeah. Well, I feel like I could ask you about 100 more questions, which means we just need to set up a time to talk again. but I thought, since we've been talking about what has come out this past year and a little before that, maybe I would just ask you to share, I don't know, just off the top of your head, 2 or 3 books that are coming out from Balzer & Bray that you're excited about, that we should watch for. Now that we've talked about sort of the feel of your books and the voice of your imprint, maybe that'll give people an idea of what is coming as well.
I would love to do that. So I told you about Adrift, which is fantastic, from Jess Oline, that is out now. We have all these great picture books.
Keep it going. I love it. Keep them coming.
You're a fan, I know, of Joseph Keefler, who did Beyond the Pond.
Do you know the special connection of Joseph's new... Share Joseph's new book. I'm so excited. I'm forgetting people are listening.
You're so funny. So his new book, Joseph is such a genius. And when you first start working with someone, you don't know what other books they have in them. And it's so exciting when an author and artist grows and develops and does something, you know, just breaks totally new ground. And Beyond the Pond was such a gorgeous book. And it was about imagination. And the art was sweeping and stunning. And so his new book is called Rulers of the Playground, and it's about this boy who decides that he's king of the playground, and then he wants to take all the, you know, all the rides and boss everybody around and make everybody do what he wants. And then this girl named Lennox decides she's the queen of the playground, and she's going to divide it by her turf and make everybody do exactly what she wants. Does that remind you of anyone? And so at its heart, it's like this funny, you know, kids know playground. They know they have to learn how to share. They're always having to share their toys and their games. And it's such a, you know, immediately when we saw this book, I was like, this is going to appeal to so many kids who are in playgrounds and having these experiences and having to learn to be generous and be friends. But now it's taken on a deeper meaning. It's about being a good person and not being, you know, greedy and a dictator.
Be a jerk.
You could end up ruining a country. So anyway, it's
Joseph and I can give you a little backstory for Joseph and I. I loved Beyond the Pond so much, and he set up an interview with Nick Patton of Picture Booking from All the Wonders. And the interview was so good, and I just straight up said to Joseph, "I can't interview you because I listened and there's nothing I could ask. Nick did such a great job with the interview." I said, "Let's make a promise to do the next book." And then one day in the mail, you sent me his new book. And even further, you were like, "Do I know anybody like that?" Alessandra, I don't think that you even know, but Joseph and I shared this immediately, that the main character in the book is Jonah, and that's my son's name. I
Oh,
was
wow. And
like,
that's his
it's
son's
his
name.
son. And I said, "Joseph, I've never seen a Jonah in a picture book." So I said, I read it to him, and he was like, "Does it really say Jonah?" And right there, let me put my finger on it. It does. And that was so cool. That just that for me, you talk about like timing and everything. Beyond the Pond wasn't the book I was meant to talk to him about. It was this next book coming out. And so that, yeah, I'm glad you brought him up because he's coming on soon. And
Oh,
it's,
he's so
oh yeah.
talented. Wait till you see the book after this one.
Oh,
Maybe I won't talk about that one yet, but it's
okay.
even better.
I'll
He
get him to
just
talk
has
about it. I'm
so
excited.
many great books in
Go ahead.
him. The next book is like, it has like shades of The Giving Tree. It's so moving. It's beautiful. The art goes to a whole new level. So he's just incredible. I think
So,
he's such a talent.
before you share another book, you've now published, or you will have published his first three books, right? This is an
Yeah.
example of, you were talking to me about sometimes when people leave a publishing house, like authors go with them. But this is one of those examples, right? Where like he, Balzer and Bray is his publisher, is how he might articulate it, right? That's
Yeah.
cool.
I feel very lucky that he has only pu I mean, he has only published with us so far. You know, people's careers are long and
Yeah.
He is also, he has another job as well. So I hope that we'll publish together forever. I'm very excited about him.
That's just cool that that happens, that people can link up that way. I like that. Okay.
Yeah,
Well,
I feel
listen.
very lucky.
You've shared Jess's book, Adrift. You've shared Joseph's book. I love that you're sharing picture books. You're welcome to share whatever you want, but I'd love to hear one more book. I know some of the stuff you have coming out, so
Wait,
I'm
I have two more I want
Yeah, girl. I'm so excited. Good.
to say.
Let this never
Well,
end.
I know. I think you've. I know you're a fan of Marlowe by Chris Brown, which is the debut. I'm really excited about that
I had
one.
no idea that that was a webcomic before. Man,
I
did I go down that? That was a, what do you call that? Like, were you
know. The rabbit hole.
rabbit
The
hole? Yeah,
rabbit
man.
hole. Yeah.
When I discovered that he had stuff online.
He's incredible. I can't believe this is his debut because I feel like he has such a confident style and his palette just blows me away.
Can't remember. Is it completely wordless, that book? It's some,
It is not. It
not
has some
quite. Okay.
text in the beginning and then it's sort of this journey of imagination. Marlowe is based on this dog, Marlowe, who he's inspired by this pit bull that he rescued when he lived in Philadelphia. He now lives in New York, but at the time he, I think he was open to adopting a dog, but so a friend of his witnessed, this would have killed me, a friend of his witnessed this pit bull puppy being like, kids were throwing rocks at it
Oh,
and it was
jeez.
really injured. So she, saint that she is, rescued Marlowe at the time and Chris adopted him. So Marlowe worked his way into his comics and eventually his first picture book. So he, that's, he's just such a soulful character. I have met this dog in person. He is as
Oh.
soulful as he is in the book. I'm a big sucker for animal stories. I'm
Right.
passionate about animals. And so just that Marlowe is taking a bath and then he goes on this journey underwater, this journey of imagination, and just the colors are so incredible, the sea creatures. And I love how he sort of hints at what's coming next in the shadows.
Yeah.
You'll see something that you don't recognize, and then you turn the page and you get the full visual. That is one of the things that I think makes a great picture book is the page turn and those surprises and those the visual payoffs. And I think he just has such a mastery of
Yeah,
color.
yeah.
There's another Marlowe coming. We signed up too
Oh,
when we signed
cool.
up. That's really exciting.
For
I
me,
think.
the. Oh, go ahead. I'm
Oh,
sorry.
go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was gonna say the thing that I'm obsessed with about that book, and this happens when. There are moments when artists do this in their books, and I just know that this is why I love them. Like Aaron Becker, when he does the same thing, so I'll say it. When Chris plays with scale in this book and shows Marlowe small and how big some of the things are under the ocean, and then we sort of, the camera sort of zooms back on Marlowe, playing with scale that way, for me is as a reader, is one of the most effective ways to really put me in that world. And that could be something that is, you know, tighter, that we're looking at, I don't know, two characters talking and then we just pull back and see the full scene. But to take something underwater and to be able to pull back as great as he does, is something that I know that readers will put their nose in that book and be surrounded by the scene that he's painted. So that, yeah, that kind of stuff. Man, I am a sucker for that.
Yeah. And I love, one thing I forgot to mention is that his rubber ducky, which is this whole impetus for going underwater, chasing his best friend, is that you can spot the ducky on every spread. And some of them are genuinely difficult to find. So I think that's a really fun kind of interactive part of it. And we call that out on the copyright page for kids and parents. Oh, so they know to look for it too.
Love it. Mm.
Yeah. All right. So my last book that I'll mention is one of Mac Barnett's. You know, a funny story about Mac Barnett is that I published his first picture book when I was at Hyperion, like 10 years ago. Yes, yes.
What's his first picture book?
His first picture book was Billy Twitters and His Blue Whale Problem.
That was the first one. Yeah, Billy Twitters with Adam Rex.
And with Adam Rex, yeah. And
so
I met Mac.
You were one of the people that was responsible for those amazing end papers with the phone number that you could call and talk to a whale.
I didn't actually get to finish that one. I left before that book came out. Okay. But I worked with Mac on the text and we signed Adam, and they're such a good pairing together. They've done lots of picture books together, but I've worked on, you know, quite a few picture books with Mac now. And I have one coming out called Places to Be, and that's coming out in April. And it is illustrated by the incredible Renata Lwiska of The Quiet Book.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And this is really, I mean, Mac is a genius in terms of text, and he's done so many different things, and he never tells a story in the way that you expect, which is what I love about him. He's so well versed in the classics, and Places to Be is really an homage to Margaret Wise Brown and Ruth Krauss, and those books that really play with language in a way that's very unexpected and very sort of elegantly spare. So this book is so tender. It's really beautiful with Renata's art. And it's just such a, you could just read this text over and over and over again. It's just such a smart, charming and classic text.
That comes out this April?
Yes.
I haven't even seen it. Yeah. Can't wait. Amazing.
Oh, you haven't seen it.
All right,
I'm going to send it to you so you can see it. I can't believe I haven't sent it to you.
This is one of those, like, I love when, we were talking off record about Best of the Year list. And one of my favorite things about Best of the Year list is just that all of us reviewers are sent different things. I said in the beginning that I value people getting to know me and sending me things that they know will, or that they think will resonate with me. But it's neat then that they send other people other stuff, and you just don't, you can't read it all. You don't get it all. And so I always look at those Best of the Year lists and go, what did I miss? I need to read these books. So no, I haven't seen that new one from Mac. That's cool.
Yeah, it's really great. Did you know that Mac went to school with John Cheska's daughter? And that was their, that's how John became a mentor to Mac. And
sort of
introduced him to Steve Malk, his agent.
All the times we talked, I did not hear that story, no.
But
Mac does have one of the greatest stories about working at summer camp.
I love that
earns
one.
Him the best place in my heart ever.
He's such a good storyteller. He really is. Yeah.
Cool. Well, that's amazing. You have cool stuff coming up. always. I'm envious of you because you're also thinking like 3 years in the future because you're acquiring stuff that'll be out. You know, stuff you can't even talk about yet. It's just exciting.
I know. I'm excited for you to see those things too.
Dude,
eventually.
I can't wait. I love it. We're in such a good world to know that this stuff is, to be the relationship that you and I and people like you and people like I have, that we're on the ends over here championing the books and putting them into kids' hands and being excited and celebrating. And you get to be on the other end of finding them and treating them the right way so that they come out in just the right way with just the right illustrators and just the right format and at just the right time. So I'm glad that we have this sort of, it wouldn't be a symbiotic relationship. Doesn't matter. It's good. It's good that we both collaborative relationship. It's wonderful. Love it. I'm so grateful, Alessandra, that you had time tonight to chat with me and to be so generous in your stories. Thank you.
Thank you for being so generous and being such a supporter of the kid lit community. I mean, you do this on your own time, I assume,
Yeah.
because you love it and you're doing such a good service for people. And so many people look to you as a guide and as, as a resource. So thank you.
Well, it's cool
Well,
that I
it's
just
cool.
get to keep being excited. And that's what fuels this on. It's just, oh, there's more
Yeah.
books. Let's talk about them. I love it. So I want to end with you having a chance to speak to students. There's listeners that are teachers and librarians that share these bits with children. So I wanted to give you a chance as well to send a message just to them. And that is, Alessandra, I'm going to see a library full of children tomorrow morning. So I want to know, what message can I bring to them from you?
That is a really tough question. I feel like, there's a lot of uncertainty right now. There's a lot of stress maybe going on at home, a lot of changes. And I would tell them that they really matter, that they're perfect as they are, no matter who they are, what they look like, that they're good kids and that they matter and that we respect them and that they're important. So, I guess I would tell them that.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them, Books Between, a podcast hosted by Karina Allen, helping to connect kids ages 8 to 12 and their parents, teachers, and librarians with books that they'll love, and the Best Book Ever This Week podcast, hosted by me, with book reviews about all sorts of amazing books. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referred to. Listeners, if this episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment at allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing this podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, David Wiesner and Donna Jo Napoli share Fish Girl, their debut graphic novel together. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's KOKO Sleep, and I'll see you there.